Welcome to Plastic Model Mojo, a podcast dedicated to scale modeling, as well as the news and events around the hobby. Let's join Mike and Kentucky Dave as they strive to be informative, entertaining, and help you keep your modeling mojo alive.
How you doing, Mike?
It's episode 90, and I'm here.
Well, good.
Got some gracious listeners, because I put up the teaser graphic yesterday, I think, and a lot of people responded to what's going to be a late drop, so thank you, folks. I apologize, but normally we record on a Sunday or Monday, and today is Thursday, and Friday is the normal drop date after record, so... Been a little busy around
here. So you got a lot of work to do after we get done recording, right?
I got about a day and a half to get it done, so we'll be all right.
Life intervenes when you have family and children, right?
Yes. So I managed to build a bridge in 2 days.
All right. Well, you're an engineer. You should be able to do that.
The laser cutter at work saved my butt, but
yeah.
And got us far down the road. So hope he gets an A on his Spanish project.
It was good looking when last I saw.
I'll have to post a picture of what I've been up to.
For yes,
you that, really. I'll add that I also paid a life tax in loaning 3 of my good paintbrushes to this endeavor.
Oh, well, you know where to get more paintbrushes.
I can get new ones, and I don't use those big giant ones very much anyways, so.
Yep.
They usually have a hefty price tag.
Yes.
Well, Dave, what's up in your model sphere?
Well, my model sphere's kind of hitting on all cylinders, other than the fact that spring has sprung here in the bluegrass state. And so I'm spending a lot of evenings and most of my weekends now out in the yard trying to rehabilitate the yard, which means a little less time modeling. But, I'm feeling great. I'm still energized from all the spring shows. I'm a little bummed we didn't get to go to the Smoky Mountain Model Con this weekend, but it just didn't work out. But all in all, I'm feeling good. How about you?
Well, luckily there's been some stuff going on. This all school stuff kind of transpired in the last, well, I don't know. It's been all week, but I've had some other things going on, at least since the last episode dropped. Listener Jeff Stuckey, I think he's down in Alabama. Goes by the handle Plastic Stash, and
yep.
He's got a Kickstarter that folks may have seen me post on the Dojo Facebook page about some organizers and a armor modeler's assembly workstation and jig that he's developing as a kind of a side hustle.
Yeah,
he sent me a preliminary one to kind of play around with, and I did that, and I sent him a list of things that he might consider before going live with that thing, and we had a nice conversation, and I look forward to see what he does. He's given me some clues that he's going to incorporate some of those things, but I'd like to see how he does it. But folks, it's out there on the Dojo. It's Plastic Stash Kickstarter page. If that's something you think you might want to support and get in on, go have a look, and we'll put it in the show notes and check out what Jeff's doing. The other thing is just a kind of an announcement. Couple of announcements from down underland. Tony Radosevic, Horizon Models, who does all the 72nd real space stuff.
Yes.
It's got a couple of things going on. Now, this first one you're going to act on soon if you're interested, but to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the last manned Mercury spaceflight, Horizon Models will be offering a couple of deals through the entire month of May. So when this drops, it's going to be the 20th. So you have about 11 days to secure your order with Tony and Horizon Models if you want in on this. He's got a couple of deals for $60 US. I would assume shipping's not included in that. It's coming from Australia. But for $60 US base, you can either get their kit 2002, the Mercury Atlas rocket, and 2004, the Mercury Redstone, two-kit combo for $60 US.
That's a deal.
He's got another one. You can get 2002, again, the Mercury Atlas. 2003, it's a Mercury spacecraft twin pack with 2004. So I guess you're going to get the Redstone and the Atlas. And what else? I'm getting this wrong, Dave. Three kit combo for $80 US.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm sure it's on his page, but they just announced something new that's going to be one of my faves.
Yes, they did. And that's the other part of this, Dave. They got a new kit release from U.S. manned spaceflight program of the 1960s. Horizon Models will be releasing a model of the Atlas Agena.
Yep.
Later this year. So can always get in on that.
Yes, absolutely. So, Mike, it's recording time. I'm assuming that you've got a modeling fluid in front of you.
I do.
Especially after the week you've had. You deserve a modeling fluid. So what modeling fluid do you have?
Well, I've been bad. About a month ago, I've scaled back what I'm putting down after about 7 p.m., which means I'm typically not imbibing during the week. But I tell you, I've had a little nip most nights this week.
Yeah.
But tonight, I'm back on the Bullet Orange Label.
Oh, good choice. In fact, that was on sale in our local liquor store here.
Well, it's a new fave versus old fave direct comparison, so we'll talk about that more at the end of the episode.
Good.
Well, what about you? What you got going on?
Well, thanks to listener Tommy Choi, who brought this to me, I think, in Indy. I've got Triptych Brewing's, and I think my spaceship knows which way to go, which is a double India Pale Ale. And it's citrus and double hopped, about 7.4% ABV. And, oh, yeah, you can taste the mango. but I think that's going to get me through the episode just fine. So we'll see how it is at the end.
Well, they also slipped a musical reference in on that title.
Well, I assume that's what that was, but I didn't know what it was from.
It's from David Bowie's Space Oddity.
I had no clue, but I was pretty sure that was a lyric from a song.
It is. Well, now we got the musical reference sorted out.
Yeah.
We ought to hit the mailbag, Dave.
Sounds like it.
Well, I know we've been getting a lot via email, and we've been getting a lot via Facebook Messenger.
Yes, we've gotten a ton.
You trying to steal my thunder?
No, I just lots of people DMing us, man. I'm telling you.
It's easier than email sometimes.
Sometimes. Especially if you got something real quick to say.
Well, from the Mid-Michigan model makers in Saginaw, Michigan, Mr. Scott Stakowiak, who's written in quite a bit before. He's got some renovations going on, and with his new space, he's discovered that he needs to redo his organization. He thinks he's got his paint bottles and that sort of stuff under control. But he's asking for good ways to organize and store common tools, knives, pliers, spare blades, brushes, glue, all the modeling accoutrement.
Mm-hmm.
And he says he's got his paintbrushes in a jar with a Tackett Z organizer. I've got one of those as well.
Yeah.
Mine's in a bean can, I think. And he wants to know what's worked for us. Scott, I think what we're going to do here is possibly not get into this in much detail, because I would like to say that sometime, hopefully sooner, not later, we hope to have Mr. Chris Wallace on the show again, model airplane maker, because not only is he doing a renovation, he's doing it in a different house. He's moving, so he's getting ready to do model workspace 2.0, and I think this will mesh finely with yes. that topic once Chris gets moved and gets his new model space squared away.
Yep. As soon as he gets that all done, and then right after he gets out of the insane asylum, we'll have him on and he can describe the process of moving and setting up an entirely new model space.
So maybe we can offer Scott a few things offline until then, but yep. just to announce, that is on our calendar for a future episode. We just don't know when yet. No pressure, Chris.
yeah. Chris.
Up next from the West Coast, up Pacific Northwest in Seattle, Mr. Mark DeRamus. He says this is not a completely foolish question, but it deserves a bit more than the Darren-esque answer. It depends. And I think he's referring to D-Ran over at the The Model Geeks Podcast.
I think
that's kind of his. That's kind of his byline.
Yeah.
Of course, it depends. But what does it depend on? And the question is, how long does it take us to finish a model? Does it depend on scale, subject, size, dedication, passion, life balance? Well, all those things.
All those things. But the one thing I'll tell you that it doesn't seem to be related to, generally, is size. I don't think a single-engine fighter takes any more or less time than a twin-engine bomber, ironically. And it doesn't seem like that should be correct, but...
I don't know, man. I think a 72nd scale single engine fighter takes way less time than a 48 scale four engine bomber.
Maybe so. Maybe so. But keeping the scale constant, I can tell you from personal experience that building a twin engine Mosquito probably took exactly the same amount of time as building a single engine P-51.
So Mark says one of the geeks claimed that his normal build was 6 to 8 months, and says his club president, a semi-pro builder, claims 30 hours to 60 days. Mark just finished a 72nd scale SR-71 Blackbird. Took 10 weeks. Says, was that too long? Was that too quick? Said John Bonanni over at the Plastic Posse Podcast. Yes. Took nearly that long on a Moosaroo P-51. Says he got a lot better results for his time.
Yes.
He says that you... say that one of your goals over the years is to be more productive at the bench. Could you please, what's he say here? Could you measure your productivity by an increase in the number of kits finished or by a decrease in the time to complete them?
I'm really looking for both.
Could this mean that his desire to complete 12 to 15 72nd scale single engine kits in a year is very unrealistic? Well, I don't know.
No, because Jeff Groves, Inch High Guy, he can batch build 12 single engine 72nd scale aircraft in a month or two. So it depends on your process. What I'm looking for right now in this trying to build faster to see that if it helps improve my modeling, one of the areas where I am focusing on is efficiency. Efficiency at the bench. You know, I have X amount of lifetime in each day or each week where I get to model because I've got children, wife, work, etc. So the number of hours, unless I'm willing to simply stop sleeping, which I don't think is going to work. The number of hours I can devote to modeling in a week is probably a pretty fixed number. But what I'm hoping to do is become more efficient during those hours. And if I become more efficient and build faster, I'm hoping that leads to more production. But this kind of brings up something that Jim Bates and I have been talking about, which is, while production and finishing models is nice, it is not the be-all and end-all of this hobby. If you're getting enjoyment out of what you're doing, if you're really enjoying and relaxing at the bench, don't necessarily put pressure on yourself to finish X number of models, because if you insert that artificial deadline, it can take some of the fun out of the hobby. So that's my basic thoughts at this point.
Well, we've been friends a long time, Dave, but you know, this is a area that we are different. I think you've got an end goal of you'd like to see more in your finished case.
Yes, I would.
And for me, yeah, I like to get them done, but I'm more of a journey type person. If you know, you got one guy who spends 5 weeks knocking out a kit start to finish and looks great, also known as John Bonanni.
Yep.
Fabulous. I wish I could paint and finish as well as he does. Maybe someday I will. I don't know. But at my build rate, that's going to take a long time, which moves me back on point. If in those same 4 to 5 weeks, I paint 12 road wheels and detail the grease nipples with grease stains and get all that done and they look awesome, I'm just as happy as if I've finished the whole dang thing, Dave.
I feel like I should insert a Beavis and Butthead. You said grease nipples.
it's interesting. For me, it really doesn't matter how long it takes, as long as when I do get to the end, I've along the way at each step, I've done everything to a degree that makes me happy.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good point.
And I don't get to post something new on Facebook every month or every, 8 weeks, whatever. I just don't. I put my progress up there and maybe people get tired of it, but I move at a glacier pace a lot of times. And that's just how I am.
Yeah.
But I'm sure having fun.
And that's the key to this thing. If you're having fun, because that's the point of a hobby. If you're not having fun, it's not a hobby. It's work.
That's true. And I'll touch on a little bit of this again when we get to the benchtop halftime report.
All right.
Oh, our good friend from Las Vegas, Dave, Joe Porche.
Yes.
Wants to say that they're going to have their Best of the West show here coming up. I don't know how many they've done now. A bunch, I'm sure. It's a pretty much a staple show out west.
Yep, that show's been there forever.
Saturday, August 19th, 2023 at the Orleans Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada. This show's brought to you by IPMS Las Vegas, Red Flag Scale Modelers, Las Vegas Model Car Club, Vegas Armor Modelers, Preservation Society, and the Gunpla Builders United. They're covering all the bases there, man.
That's why I was good to see that even though they may have separate clubs, an AMPS chapter, an IPMS chapter, a Gunpla club, a car club, it's good to see them all unite for a contest because they're all forms of modeling. And, I enjoy seeing stuff, even if it's not particularly the subject matter that I build regularly. So I'm happy to see clubs getting together and cooperating like that, because that's not always the case.
And finally, from the email side of things, Dave, Lynn Young from Donaldsonville, Louisiana, he references some of our conversations about historic photos veterans have or families of veterans have. And you've talked about this and how a lot of stuff may be lost.
Yep.
Lynn was going through his wife's grandfather's material. He served in World War II in the army and found a set of German pictures from the Polish campaign.
Oh, wow. See, that's the stuff that I'm talking about. That's the stuff that's going to disappear here in the next 20 years. And I am so desperate for someone somewhere to figure out how to organize to rescue this stuff before somebody throws that in the trash.
Well, I'd be curious if these were unique snapshots or if they were sometimes in the canteens you could buy
propaganda shots,
propaganda company photo sets from some of these campaigns, or sometimes there's stereoscope, a stereoscope, a stereoscopic viewer, the Viewmaster of the 40s and 50s, pretty much is what it is, right? Yeah. Sets of photos from some of these campaigns. Sometimes they were provided with a book on the campaign. They'd publish a book and the stereoscope and the slides would be in the back of the book. But anyway, I'm just curious what they were.
Ask him to scan them and send them to you.
They had no interest in retaining them, so they contacted the National Holocaust Museum and donated them, and they'll archive and preserve the photos. He encourages anyone with photos or mementos that they don't want to keep to contact a museum that curates the subject and ask if they would accept the donation. That's not a bad idea. There are other options that folks would want to consider. I see a lot of this in my military collecting hobby. For a one-off thing like this, where it's a veteran and it's just a small amount of something, you don't want to pursue other venues, and sure, that's a fine thing to do. To be honest, the one that irks me is when some fairly advanced collector says, "I'm just going to donate all this to such and such museum when I die." That one I don't agree with, primarily because, for one, the bedrock of the museum systems in this country are the private collectors.
Yeah.
An example of that was when the centennial of World War I came around. A lot of museums in this country were scrambling for display material. Do you know why?
Because they don't bother to keep that as a regular item in their museum.
That's right. Those were in the possession of the museum, and when they wanted other stuff, they sold it.
Yeah.
So
sold it if we were lucky.
Yes, that's probably true, but they did not retain it. So that's something to keep in mind. And the other part is, if you have that much stuff and you've had it a long time, the value's appreciated, I would feel you're really doing your heirs and family a disservice to give that away and not let them reap the benefits of a sale of that material.
Sure.
Well, that's my opinion.
And usually with a collector like that, with a large collection, they've curated a really, they've curated a particular set of items, and you kind of want to see that be able to continue in private hands, because a lot, again, like you say, a lot of collectors lend out to museums. In fact, you go to the Naval Air Museum or the U.S. Air Force Museum, you will see in displays signs saying this item here on loan from or courtesy of, where they've been long-term lent to the museum. So
now, folks, don't get me wrong. I'm not criticizing what Lynn has done here. That's perfectly fine for what he had. And
yeah,
that's cool that they accepted the material. But if you got a lot of stuff and you're a collector, that's who I'm talking to.
Well, and what I want to plead is, listen, if you have grandparents who are getting up there in years, or grandparents who have recently died that were World War II veterans, please, when you go through their stuff, unfortunately, I can tell you as an attorney who deals with probate and estate matters, a lot of times the concern is about the financially significant items, and the family photos and stuff like that, a lot of times don't get any attention, end up in a dumpster or something like that. I'm begging you, go through their stuff, see if there are photos like this, and do something with them to preserve them.
Exactly.
Whatever it is, just preserve them, because there's stuff in photographs out there that, A, is of great historical significance, but also to us modelers, there are things in backgrounds of photos that pop up even to this day that people are like, well, I've never seen that particular set of markings. I've never seen that particular variant. So, you know, this is important. Part of what we do because we all like history. And I hope that people will make the effort to preserve stuff like this, or at least look for it.
So, Lynn, good on you for taking the step.
Amen.
Those will at least be archived and preserved for posterity, and they won't be lost to the dumpster.
Amen.
Well, Dave, I think that's it. I will double check here. Yes, the other stuff is things to populate the wheel of accidental wisdom the next time we run that episode. So wheel's filling up, though.
Yes, I'm glad the wheel's refilling, because we really put a dent in it when you, Evan, and I did it. So I'm looking forward to doing another wheel. Well, Mike, as you mentioned earlier, we did get a lot of DMs, and I'm going to run through them. Robbie Knopfs reached out. As you know, he's a YouTuber. He's got a channel, The Model Guy. And we had commented about, people. How YouTube was such a great benefit for modelers coming in or coming back into the hobby. But one of the downsides was that it could lead to frustration, because you watch a video on somebody doing some technique and then you can't replicate it the first time you try it. But Robbie reached out to said he hopes that his YouTube channel encourages people to try new things, and that, yes, he tries a new technique numerous times before he actually films it. And so it's not something that just magically happens the first time you try something you saw on YouTube. But he still hopes that it provides encouragement to folks to try the new stuff. And I think that's a real good point.
I know I do.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And talked to Steve Husted. He absolutely talks about how he spends probably more time testing things than actual building of a model. And you see his results. Stephen Lee reached out because we talked about tools. And Stephen is in true form, went long form on us. And so his DM is really too long to get into. But it's just a good reminder. We need to schedule him and have him back on to have a discussion because he talked a lot about different tools and stuff. But one thing he did remind me of that has come on lately that I know a number of modelers have tried and liked is glass files. Using glass files as opposed to emery boards or sanding sticks or regular metal files. And he seems to be really, really pleased with the glass files. So make a note somewhere, pencil him in. We got to have another talk with Stephen. Next is George Welch reached out. You know, I've talked about the tremors that the essential tremors that I suffer from and the medicine and all that I'm taking and my experience with all that. Well, George reached out because he has the same problem and he is also on medication and talked about that journey. But what he really mentioned was that he found more challenging than the tremors was his vision. And trying the different things to enhance or help your vision when modeling. And he said he tried readers, you know, buying a set of readers or reading glasses. He didn't like the optivisor, that he didn't like the feel of it on his head. So for him, what has worked out most is one of those lamps with the magnifier in the center. And, you know, the light all around it. And he said that has allowed him to continue to model even though his eyes have faded. I've got one of those. I use it occasionally, but I'll be honest with you. For me, the Optivisor is my go-to tool. But I know some people like Dr. Miller use readers. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there that you, can help you as your vision gets a little bit wonky as you get older.
I can't work under a single magnifying lens. I just have depth perception problems doing that. So
right.
Good on him if he can make that work. I can't. The Optivisor I like.
Right.
Till, you know, I've had it on for 4 hours and I'm sweating around the band and I got a big red mark across my forehead.
Yeah.
But nobody sees it, but you know, the wife, I guess.
Yeah.
I've got this trifocal thing going. I've got on readers under my Optivisor because even with the Optivisor on without the readers, my real near stuff is still not real good.
Yeah.
And then I'm looking above my glasses and under the Optivisor for other things like washing my paintbrush or yeah, whatever. And yeah, sometimes I might have an accident or brush something inadvertently. Kind of sucks to be honest.
Yep. Yep.
I don't know what.
Youth and young eyes are wasted on the young man.
Yes, they are.
Well, Ed Barrett reached out and he raised a point, and I'm not sure I get what his point is. So we may have to have him back on or talk about, because I'm not sure I 100% got his point. He's talking about accuracy and fidelity and the fact that if you're building two different manufacturers' models of the same prototype item, just take 72nd scale P-51s, and you build Tamiya and Airfix and Arma, that even though they're the same item, they're not necessarily going to look exactly the same, and whether or not they should be painted, weathered, and treated the same. And I'm not sure the point he's getting at, so we're going to have to talk to him about that. Did you see that DM?
I did. And part of it is this whole engineer versus artist kind of dichotomy, I guess.
Yes.
He suggests that respect for the subject, regardless of the kit or manufacturer, is kind of an engineering perspective. Whereas respect for the model, regardless of detailed differences versus other manufacturers' kits or whatnot, is more of an artistic view. What do we think is a common view, or do we agree or disagree? Should an identical subject from two manufacturers end up looking the same? Should they be the same? What do we think about that? I think I understand what he's getting at. The engineer in me says that if you build a Tamiya 48 scale P51 Mustang, and who else makes one? I don't know.
Hasegawa
48 scale P51 Mustang. Should they look the same when they're done? The engineer in me says yes. They're 48 scale models. They're the exact same thing.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
Now
that's my attitude.
However, the kit design and detailing philosophy between those two different manufacturers may not be the same.
Right. Probably are not
the same. And in that, I mean, one company, and I don't know the kit, so I'm not saying right. which one's which, but in right. general, brand A versus brand X, right?
Yeah.
Brand A might want the visual representation at the end to have some pop or some pizzazz. So they may, for better or worse, overemphasize panel lines and rivets.
Mm-hmm.
At the expense of accuracy, they've given you some eye candy.
Right.
Essentially, right? Whereas brand X might hold a higher fidelity of scale. Something very contemporary is the Qatari Spitfire, right?
Yeah.
Folks are talking about the rivets and the panel lines on that kit and where they are and where they aren't and why they didn't do it versus other manufacturers who did, whatever. So the design philosophy, the scale versus detail compromises and enhancements from one versus the other are not going to be the same necessarily. So in the end, the two models aren't going to look the same unless you're really good at some clever painting. Possibly yes. they could.
Right.
But in the end, a well-finished model from either manufacturer, if you play on the attributes that they've emphasized, I think they're both going to be exceptional models. And at 3 or 4 feet, I don't think you're going to tell much difference in them.
Yeah. No, I agree. So, but that's I knew he was thinking engineer-like, so I knew you would probably understand it a little better than I would.
Yeah, from an absolute technical perspective, imagine a contest, brand A, brand X, go make a model of this aircraft, and we're going to judge them on technical accuracy when you're done. Well, at the end of that contest, by God, they ought to be pretty close to the same thing, right?
Right.
But that's not all that's going on in a scale model. There's this
right.
nuanced, this team's got this philosophy or style, maybe would be a better way to put it, that tool design well, style.
And not and
they're
going to
be different.
Ease of construction. Some manufacturers make compromises that they deem acceptable to make the model easier to build. And those things are going to factor in as well.
So, Ed, I hope we got what you're getting at. I don't know. Yeah. If we didn't, he'll let us know.
He'll let us know, exactly. Well, this next one is a crowdsource. I'm looking for some help here. Alias Bob Smith, who's actually David from Ithaca, New York, but he goes by Bob Smith online. He's building 72nd scale aircraft, and he's chosen to go plane on a pole on some of them. He wants to do some in flight. And that means he needs pilot figures. But as he remarks, most pilot figures that actually come with the kit, if they do at all, are usually not very good. And he specifically is talking about World War II, U.S. Army Air Corps, U.S. Navy, and Japanese World War II pilots. And he's looking for some suggestions for aftermarket pilots, be they 3D printed or injection molded. I know there are some manufacturers out there who do some pretty decent injection molded ones. I think it's Hasegawa does a set of World War II Japanese pilots in injection molding as a separate kit, a separate item for sale. But there's been an explosion in 3D printing, and so I kind of like to crowdsource this and have you all send in your suggestions for pilot figure, aftermarket 72nd scale pilot figures that you've experienced and the ones that you think are the best. And I want to be able to pass it on to him next episode. So that's your task. Go out there and give me some suggestions.
Any more on the Facebook side, Dave?
I got two more. Dave Owens of West Hartford, Connecticut reached out. He listened to our last episode, and this story is not uncommon. He modeled some when he was younger. Then he got into model trains and has been in the hobby as a model train enthusiast. But now he's starting to come back to broadening out and doing aircraft and military models again. So he wanted to thank us for all of the stuff we were talking about in regard to the crossovers between model railroading and scale modeling. And it just so happens we have something else in common. He's another one of those modelers who has adopted daughter from China, just like I have too. And we've got other listeners who have also. And it's kind of nice to, that's again, another thing you've got in common where you've already got similar experiences and can immediately upon meeting, just meeting another modeler, if you meet somebody who's gone through that experience, you already have a common language about when did you go, where did you go, where is your daughter from, what was your experience, et cetera, et cetera. So it was kind of nice just to exchange photos and talk a little bit about our trip. He went right before mine. He went in 03, I went in 05 and 2010. So It was just a pleasant little discussion, so I enjoyed that. Finally, Lynn Young, who apparently is gotten himself appointed as the social media director for his local chapter, is now trying to feel his way along as a brand new social media director who doesn't necessarily know that much about social media. And he reached out to us because down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, on October 7th, they are holding the Cajun Model Fest. And he wanted us to mention the Cajun Model Fest being held October 7th in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And I told him I'd be happy to do it. And I also encouraged him to post a flyer in the dojo. And I want to take this time to tell any of our listeners who are in a club, who's having a contest, please feel free to post a copy of your flyer and even a link to your club or contest website in the dojo. We've got no problem with that. We want people going to contests. If you've been listening to these episodes, all 89 of the previous ones, you know that I think at least that contests are a big part of this hobby that modelers miss out on for any number of reasons. And so I'm encouraging folks to go to contests. Go to as many contests as you can. So if you got a contest out there, post a flyer in the dojo. We got no problem with that. And hopefully Mike and I, we've been to at least I've been to a fair number of contests this spring, and I'm hoping that we're going to get to a fair number more during the rest of the year.
We can only hope, Dave.
You got it.
Anything else?
That's it from the DM side. Well, this is the point in the episode where I ask you, when you get done listening, please rate us on whatever podcast app you're using. Please give us 5 stars. It helps drive the visibility of the podcast. In addition, if you know another modeler who isn't listening to the podcast, maybe they don't know what a podcast is, please recommend us to them. Help them if they need a little help to download a podcast app and get subscribed. One of the ways we continue to grow, and yes, believe it or not, 90 episodes in, we're continuing to have new listeners come on, is recommendations from current listeners. So please, we'd appreciate that. We'd consider it a favor if you do that.
In addition to that, please check out the other podcasts out in the Model Sphere, folks. There's a lot of good content out there. You can get to a lot of that by going to www.modelpodcast.com. That's Model Podcast, plural. It's a consortium website set up with the help of Stuart Clark from Scale Model Podcast up in Canada. And we've aggregated the banner links for all the podcasts who wish to participate in the Spirit of Cross promotion. So you can go to that website and check out a bunch of the other podcasts. We appreciate if you do that. In addition to the podcast, we've got a lot of blog and YouTube friends out there in the model sphere. Jim Bates of Scale Canadian TV has got a YouTube channel. Chris Wallace, Model Airplane Maker, YouTube channel and a blog. All kinds of good stuff going on there. Stephen Lee, we mentioned earlier, Sprue Pie with Frets, got a nice long and short form blog. I think we do need to have him back because he had a lot to say about tools.
Yes, he did.
Jeff Groves, the Inch High Guy blog, all things 72nd scale. You can find that on the internet, Inch High Guy blog. And Mr. Evan McCallum, Panzermeister 36, a great YouTube channel dealing with armor model construction and weathering.
Did you mention Jim?
First, I mentioned Jim first, Dave.
Okay. Sorry. I didn't catch him.
That's part where you weren't listening.
Probably. If you listeners out there are not a member of your national IPMS chapter, IPMS USA, IPMS Canada, IPMS Australia, IPMS England, whichever, please consider joining your national organization. Even if you're a member of your local club, please join the national organization as well. These umbrella chapters, national umbrella chapters, do a lot to facilitate the local chapters in their countries. They also do a fair amount of information sharing between chapter or between the national chapters. And it's well worth a very little cost to become a national member. So if you would, please join IPMS USA, IPMS Canada, or your local national chapter.
All right, Dave, let's take a pause here and hear from our sponsor. Plastic Model Mojo is now brought to you by Model Paint Solutions, your source for Harder Steenbeck airbrushes, David Union power tools, and laboratory-grade mixing, measuring, and storage tools for use with all your model paints, be they acrylic, enamels, or lacquers. Check them out at www.modelpaintsolutions.com. Come and make it in Texas, Dave.
We're under 100 days, aren't we?
We are well under 100 days. Now, given the shift to the right on our recording date, I think at the time of this recording, we are 77 days away from the IPMS National Convention in scalding San Marcos, Texas.
That explains why my hands are getting the palms of my hands are getting itchy. When it gets close every year, man, I'm going to have to start packing soon.
You probably will. Rental car is reserved. Got that taken care of.
Evan has made his flight arrangements.
Now, I hope he booked a changeable ticket in case the unthinkable happens.
He not only is booked, but he's checked in already.
He's more anxious than you.
Yes.
It's kind of cold up there. I get it.
Yeah, you and I, speaking of which, you and I have to figure out the logistics because he gets in at 10 o'clock on Monday night. So we're leaving at dark whatever the next morning. So you and I have to talk logistics.
Yeah, we probably should. Well, that's not all we got to talk about.
All right, go ahead.
Mojovian Special Agent 003, Mr. Brandon Jacobs, has come through again as planned. Mr. Reliability.
I am looking forward to having a beer with that man in Texas.
Well, he says we're getting close, so let's zero in on food and beer, Dave.
Always.
It's time to talk about the tap room and the porch.
Okay.
The tap room and the porch are two establishments that are connected to each other and are run by the same people. They're located on the square in downtown San Marcos, Texas. Again, it's about 10 minutes from the convention center. Not walkable, but it takes 10 minutes or less in a car, I presume. Well, he says this would be the place to go if somebody just wanted to get away for lunch or dinner, but did not want to go very far. The square is a nice place and should have something for all attendees to enjoy. If the Nats attendee was to leave the convention center only once, this is where they should go for lunch. And he provides a summary from the tap room and the porch, I guess from their website or maybe their menu or both. Award-winning burgers, 42 drafts from Texas and all over the world, established in 1994. Check out our sister bar, The Porch, for live music, DJs, and events. Only one location, right on the square in historic downtown San Marcos. They specialize in half-pound burgers, fried chicken wings, handmade appetizers, and sandwiches and salads and more. Come join us for all the sports programming you can handle, live music, etc. at The Porch. Tap room is open Sunday through Wednesday, 11:30 a.m. to 12 a.m., and Thursday through Saturday from 12:30 a.m. to 1 a.m. The Tap Room and the Porch, 129 East Hopkins Street, San Marcos, Texas. I could get into a half-pound burger.
I was going to say, that sounds like the kind of food modelers eat, you know?
You know, half-pound burger, you can eat breakfast at the hotel.
Right.
Dodge lunch.
And pack on the feed bag.
Go to dinner early, because you don't want to go and eat a half-pound burger at 8 p.m., man.
Right.
At least I don't.
you're gonna be lucky to get any sleep those 4 days.
You're probably right, but Brandon, we appreciate all the imbibement and culinary opportunities you're providing us in the San Marcos, the greater San Marcos area. So folks, go back and listen to all the Come and Make It in Texas episodes, and we can hopefully provide you with some places to go that aren't the normal chains, etc. I always like checking out the local fair.
Me too.
Fair and flair when I go to anything, not just a model show, just any kind of town. I mean,
yeah. You can eat the chains anytime you want, but if you're someplace that you've never been before, try to find the local stuff.
Take a chance. Ask some questions. Find a good spot.
Get yourself a special agent like we got.
Well, we mentioned Tackett Z earlier from one of the listener mails. The Benchtop Halftime Report, Dave, brought to us by Tackett Z. Tackett Z, the must-have tools from the model maker. You can check out everything going on there at www.tackettz.com. Hopefully Ed's doing well, and maybe we'll see him soon.
Yes.
Dave, what's on your bench?
Well, several things. Three main ones. One, the F8 Crusader. That has to be done in 77 days. Well, actually, so about 75 days, because it's got to make it down to the Nationals for the Model Geeks group display. The little Hasegawa fuel truck that I started just kind of as an enjoyment side build. The Crusader's about to get closed up. The fuselage is about to get closed up, and it'll go very quick from there. The little fuel truck is together, and I've started painting and weathering some aspects of it. And then over in the repair area, I continue to repair models from the trip to HeritageCon. And right now, the one in the repair spot is the Arma Hurricane. I'm reattaching the landing gear and the gear door. Once I do that, I'll be able to set it up, put it in a display case, and who knows, I may bring that down to Texas. That may just for the fun of it. I may actually bring that thing down to Texas. But I'm making progress. I'm having fun. I'm building faster in general, which is one of my goals. So I got no complaints. How about you?
Well, did I miss one? You said three, and you talked about a truck and
the truck, the F8, and then the repair of the P-51. I was counting the repair as one of the three.
Okay. Well, hopefully that turned out all right.
Yeah, it's getting there.
Well, since last episode, I've gotten a week's worth of bench time in and then a week of zero bench time.
Having kids is great, man. It is.
That's what we told Evan the other
night. It is true. It is great. That doesn't mean that there aren't challenges.
In retrospect, as I mentioned.
Yes, that's right.
Well, let me think. Last episode, I was trying to get the base for the KV85 ready to pose the suspension.
Mm-hmm.
I think last time I'd already put the Vallejo textured acrylic paste on it.
Yep.
And looking over, that's exactly where it is right now. Because I'd ordered the Smart Mud from VMS.
Did somebody particular recommend that Smart Mud to you?
No, I thought of it all on my own.
Okay.
If the order finally showed up, I say finally, not that it took too long or something happened. I was anxious to get it and it shows up and then I can't work on it because I can't get myself to the bench.
Yeah.
Just looking at the stuff in the tub, it's really a bizarre material.
Really?
Yeah. Hard to explain.
I'm going to want to see posts on the dojo. And B, I'm going to want to hear you describe why you describe it as bizarre.
It's really interesting, consistency and properties. But more on that after I've actually played around with it.
Yeah.
As I mentioned last time, again, in the last episode, I'm trying to break this serial nature to my builds where usually it's a technical problem that stops me. And I'll think that through to the nines and just not do anything else on a project until I figure that out. Then I'll fix that and then I'll move on to the next thing. I'm trying not to do that on the KV85 or it's just going to take forever. And there's stuff I could be doing. So I'm waiting on this stuff to finish the base. So I start the turret and we talked about this last time. Since the last episode, I've been working on the commander's cupola, painting the vision blocks. It's a nice part. It's got, again, this kid is an organically kind of rubber mold resin cast kind of affair, old school. Mm-hmm. It's really well done. And I mentioned before, it's got all the warts and hangups that sort of thing has, pore blocks and flash along the mold parting lines and stuff like that, but not too bad. I give this one A+ based on some of the stuff from, 15, 20 years ago. But I painted the vision blocks. I painted the inside of the turret. I mixed up a custom off-white color for the inside of the cupola. I chose to paint the armored glass vision blocks as if they were like a part that was brought into the factory complete from a second-tier supplier. So the metal parts on the armored blocks are not the off-white color. They're kind of a 4BO color, right? Because that's what a lot of the Russian optics are, regardless of which side of the tank they're on, the inside or the outside, because they were supplied by some third party. They just painted them one color. And a lot of the Russian optics is a particular shade of 4BO or a particular shade of green that is considered 4BO. It's within the spectrum of 4BO, I guess. That's a whole nother topic.
Yeah.
And then, I did some detail painting, the washes, et cetera, and some highlighting. And I've got all that assembled now. I've also painted the inside of the turret black. Because really, the only thing I want visible through the turret is the inside of the cupola and the vision blocks.
Yeah.
I want to be just a total black hole after that. So I mentioned in private conversation, I might borrow a few cc's of that dead black paint. We got some of that stuff at work.
Mm-hmm.
That we use for some things. And it's just a real thick, heavy acrylic paint and a dollop of that and a centrifuge tube and a bunch of thinner, and I can spray this thing and it'll be so damn black you can't see anything.
I was going to say, that stuff is amazing. I'm not sure the listeners know what you're talking about. They've developed when you say black paint just doesn't exactly get what this is. It is super black paint.
It's like super black. It's dead flat. It has incredible light absorption. So you can spray this stuff on a 3D object and you can't tell it's a 3D object anymore.
Right.
I mean, it's really weird. But we use it for a lot of vision applications where we want to black out a lot of stuff for field of vision to focus right. on other things in a like a payload we're building.
Right.
But man, a little bit of this crap would go a long way. I mean, I may end up buying a bottle of this stuff. Pretty cool.
Well, I can't wait to see it. I'll bet you it's hard to photograph.
probably is. Nothing to focus on.
Exactly.
You can't tell the near or far.
If you actually do this, I want you to take a photograph of it, see if you can even get a real good photograph of what this is.
It's interesting. I don't know if I've seen any of it used in the model sphere yet.
No, I don't think I have either.
So maybe I'm a pioneer, but
there you go.
We'll see.
Well, both AK and MIG Ammo will be releasing their own Super Black paint soon, now that probably. They've heard this podcast.
And a couple other people.
Yeah.
For good measure.
Yep.
Well, I've got the VMS Smart Mud. I'm ready to rock and roll on the base. Hopefully a bit more of an update next time. I've really not made any further progress on the E16. Though, I tell you, our guest for this episode has got me fired up to get back on the airplane.
He was pushing on you, wasn't he?
Yeah, I know. More on that later.
Yep. Mike, let's talk some faves and yawns. We haven't done that in a little while. There have been a fair number of announcements. You know, we're in the spring. I know Shinazuka's going on. There's all sorts of course, now it seems like announcements come out every day all year. So, do you have some faves and yawns?
I do. I'll start with a fave, Dave.
Go for it.
I know you're not a fan of this vehicle, but TACOM has released or is planning to release here in the near future a series of three Hetzer kits, an early, mid, and late production with full interior.
Have all three been previously done in 35th scale?
I want to say yes, and I think I can break it down. I think let's go back up about, probably 20 years at this point, but Edward released a 35th scale Hetzer series with full interior. I think they had three kits. I think they had an early, mid, and late. And to be honest, for what Edward was doing, you know, primarily photo etch,
right,
was how they came onto the scene, right?
Yeah.
And then they got into kits. I believe this was some of their... Well, it's definitely their first, maybe only armor kits. They just didn't live up to the hype. The interiors weren't particularly good. You would have thought a company who had cut their teeth in photo etch would have had extensive photo etch included in the kits. And what that was included was pretty rudimentary, you know, small fret. Detail all around was not great. So they're out there. Back in the day when they came out, they got mostly favorable reviews, but their shortcomings were noted. To me, it has a nice mid-production Hetzer.
Mm-hmm.
And then Academy has an early, and maybe some others, I don't know. So there's certainly a path to get these three versions of the Hetzer from other manufacturers. You know, I was planning an early Hetzer to be built with a Tamiya mid and backdating it. That's still kind of the avenue I'm probably going to take because it doesn't have a full interior. But I'm real curious to see where these go, see how good these kits are. I think if you completely open up the Hetzer's fighting compartment, it's tight in there, but you can actually see quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
If you open up all the hatches, same with the engine compartment. So this one might be mostly worthwhile, I think. It's just to see how they do it. I'm real curious. I like the vehicle. And there's a couple I'd like to do, and I'll keep my eye on this. What about you? What's your first fave, Dave?
Well, my first fave is a company called Aztec Models. They have released a 72nd scale. Gonna butcher this because my Turkish is awful. A Bayraktar TB2. It's the drone that has been, the UAV, not drone, the UAV that has been used. It's manufactured in Turkey. The Ukrainians acquired a bunch of them right before the current conflict, and they've done some pretty spectacular work in Ukraine. and this is a 72nd scale, which, by the way, in 72nd scale, this thing's going to be tiny. It's probably not going to be more than a couple of inches by a couple of inches, but it's in the news. It's, you know, something that is on the battlefield being used, and definitely historically significant enough that I wouldn't mind having a kit of it. You got another?
Well, my next one's a fave. And, you know, I think Evan McCallum mentioned this when he was on last. Dynamo Models.
Yeah.
They've been making some Battle of France era figures, some French figures.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when he mentioned it was some soldiers on the march or machine gun team on the march. Well, they've come out with several other sets, and there's a cavalry set that's looks to be really nice. I think these are printed figures.
Uh-huh.
Based on the screenshots I've seen, there's CAD work involved, so I suspect they're printed. The painted up specimens look really good, and just some really interesting looking figures.
You know what? That reminds me of something. That I am amazed at the number of figure manufacturers who don't seem to seek out really, really talented painters to do their box top or advertising versions of their figures. Because as you well know, I mean, it's becoming more and more in aircraft and armor where painting and technique, you know, really can do a lot to enhance a model. But with figures, painting technique and all of that is, you know, can take a mediocre figure, make it look good. On the other hand, a less than talented paint job can take what is otherwise a really good figure and make it look not so good. So I'm always amazed that these figure manufacturers are not seeking out the top talent as far as figure painting goes.
Well, I think some of them are, for sure.
Well, some of them are, absolutely. And some of them are run by guys who are really talented painters. Alpine comes to mind for me.
Oh, certainly, yeah. Yeah, several others. But, yeah, I can see your point.
Yeah.
Why would you not do that?
Exactly.
Maybe it's money. I don't know.
It may be. Well, my next one's a fave, and this is going to be kind of out of left field.
Okay. Maybe buckle up.
Okay. A company called Cosmic Scale Models, that's COZMIC, Scale Models, have released a set of 72nd scale figures to go with the Star Trek original series shuttle, crew figures to go with the shuttle. And you know what? I remember that kit. I built it. You know, I was a fan of Star Trek when I was younger. I remember that shuttle kit. I built it. And yeah, you need crew figures with it. And I'm happy to see somebody filling that void. So, you know, that may not be the thing I'd build today, but you know, it's nice for the guys who still are into that and who want to do that to have that in their tool set. So I'm going to fave that one for all of those guys.
Well, elaborate a little bit. Is it a bunch of generic red shirts are going to beam down and get slaughtered, or
it's four figures?
Are they personalities?
They actually give you it's actually the shuttle itself and the four figures. There's one guy who's a Vulcan who's looking very stoic. There's one guy who's looking kind of buffed up, and one guy who looks like he's got a medical tricorder on his hip. But they haven't necessarily infringed on any copyrights.
Okay. And then the fourth guy looks like he's not coming back.
That's exactly what I was going to say. The fourth guy's not going to survive the trip. You're a bad person.
That's the way it always works, man.
I know.
The only red shirts that survive are the ones who never leave the Enterprise.
Exactly. And even then, they sometimes don't make it.
That's right.
So you got another one?
I've had two phases. I've got a yawn, or possibly better defined as confusion.
Okay.
This is from the Shizuoka Hobby Show in Japan.
Yep.
There's been a lot of hype around Fine Molds Type 95 kit.
Yeah.
Coming out of this show.
Yeah.
They even had a real one at the show venue.
Yeah.
They've had a Type 95 kit since 1992.
Yes, they have. You're right.
Mojovia, what's the score here? What have they done? What am I missing? Is this a complete redo of this kit, or are they re-releasing it because it hasn't been available for 10 years? What's going on? I don't get it. I want one. I've never bought one. I'd love several of their kits. I've got one Japanese tank from Fine Molds. There's about four others I'd like to have.
Okay, it's sad. I've got at least two.
And we've both built zero, Dave.
Yes, that's right. Okay, touche.
Somebody tell me what's going on, because I've been a little bit distracted during the week of this show, and I'm getting probably low-level information. I just want to know what's going on. Do I need to buy this kit, or is it the same as all the others and it's just being re-released? I don't know.
Well, I've got a final fave, and that is one we mentioned earlier, Horizon Hobbies. Who do the fantastic series of 72nd scale rockets. They have released a new rocket, which builds in part on what they've released previously. They previously released an Atlas rocket in a couple of versions, one as an ICBM and one as a launcher for the Mercury program. But now they're releasing what's called an Atlas Agena, which was the same rocket used to launch the Agena docking target it was the next step in the space program between the Mercury and the Gemini, and was used as to build on the success that they'd had with the Mercury. So it's the rocket body is pretty much the same, but the payload is different. It fills another hole in 72nd scale space history, real space history, and I'm definitely going to be picking one of those up.
Got any more, Dave?
That's it for me.
Getting the right size base for your model, diorama, or vignette can be difficult and time-consuming. Bases by Bill has the solution with their all-new custom-sized display bases. Offering sizes of 4 to 30 inches, you can choose the dimensions you want and get the size you need every time. And they can laser engrave the base with a unit emblem or text to your specifications. Better still, shipping is included within the lower 48 states. Built by modelers for modelers, Bases by Bill has bases and display cases for any type of model and for any size. Visit their website at basesbybill.com to see their products or to get your own custom-built base or display case quote. Use the code MOJO at checkout to apply a 15% listener discount to your order. That code again is MOJO for 15% off. Bases by Bill for all your model display needs.
Well, Dave, I got my E16 base going with Bases by Bill.
Yes, you do.
I can't wait to see it.
Yep.
Christian sent me an email, I think it was last week, that it was in the queue for this week, so maybe soon. Good. I tell you.
That'll get you moving.
It will. You know, it may be better than the model by the time it's all done. Well, let's move on to our special segment tonight, Dave. Water, Snow, and Ice. Plastic Model Mojo recurring personality, Mr. Steve Husted, is back once again, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about his techniques for these terrain features and scenery features. So how about we get into that, Dave?
Looking forward to it.
Well, Dave, we have a recurring friend back. Steve Husted's back once again for another segment with the Plastic Model Mojo. Steve, how you doing tonight?
I'm good, guys. How are you doing?
Good as usual.
Good.
You all right, Dave?
Yes, I'm really looking forward to this one, simply because it's Steve's done a lot of dioramas, including water, snow, and ice, and the way he pulls it off in using different techniques and different mediums is really, really effective. So I am looking forward to picking his brain on all of this stuff.
Well, Dave gave the title away, or at least the subject matter. So modeling water, snow, and ice effects, and I guess Steve primarily in 72nd scale, but a lot of the stuff's applicable to other scales as well. Where do you want to start, Steve?
Well, it's like Dave said, it's all kind of diorama oriented, and you know, as we all know, there's kind of four components that make up a diorama, and that's kind of the vehicle or aircraft and groundwork, figures, and composition. And this is kind of snow, water, and ice goes toward the groundwork part, and it's just one of those features that a lot of modelers find very difficult to replicate, no matter what the scale is. And I think we've been helped out in recent years with a lot of new products by a lot of new manufacturers, and some of the old methods, tried and true, have kind of gone by the wayside because they've been replaced with better ones. But yeah, we've done. It's a difficult thing. The water and snow especially has been kind of a problem for modelers all along, and ice in particular is kind of a specialty offshoot of the two. But living up here in Minnesota, we know ice, snow, and water. So
yeah, so you do have the advantage when you're doing a snow diorama that at least 7 or 8 months out of the year you can simply look out your window for reference.
Yeah, I can look out my window in July and I can see the snow. And the
Land of 1,000 lakes, right?
Yeah, that's right. 10,000.
10,000
lakes.
Yeah. And I know at Vikings games, they often play in the winter. The home games, they play a Led Zeppelin song that has some phrase of the land of the ice and snow in there, and they're blasting that at the stadium. So,
well, why don't we start with water before we freeze everything?
Yeah.
There you go. Let's start with mild temperatures and go from there.
Okay. Yeah. Well, water is, I've used that in, maybe 7 or 8 dioramas now. Techniques have remained the same for the most part, but added a few wrinkles as we go on. And I guess the thing I've gravitated to mostly now is using a 2-part epoxy resin for water. And I use a product called Envirotex Light, which is kind of a 1-to-1 mix of a hardener and a resin. And there are some other equivalent ones that you can get at Michael's or Hobby Lobby, but that's the one I've kind of gravitated to.
Where do you get yours?
I get mine at Michael's craft stores.
Oh, okay.
But I've seen them at Hobby Lobby lately too, and I've seen Hobby Lobby seems to have kind of a proprietary brand of their own, which is probably equivalent, but I can't vouch for it. But
gotcha.
And the stuff works. It's perfectly clear. It's, like I say, a resin material. It mixes 1-to-1. I think AK has a product out that's a 2-part resin, but that's a 2-to-1 mix now, so you have to watch the instructions. But the stuff, you mix it up in polyethylene containers. Don't use polystyrene.
That would be bad.
It could be, but I found it tends to – the polyethylene is resistant to everything, like John Miller says. He sells some of those beakers, and that's kind of perfect for that because it resists everything. But the Envirotex Light mixes 1-to-1. It's perfectly clear. You can tint it with enamels, so you can kind of build up layers. But what the stuff is made for, it's made for like bar tops and tables like you see in restaurants, and it goes on like an eighth inch or less, and then it dries, and they can layer up different layers. And but the stuff dries perfectly clear, perfectly flat. And it's one of those materials, when you pour it in, you know, your shell hole or your when you've got a ship model or something, when you pour it in, it always dries perfectly flat. You can rework the stuff and try and work waves into it, even at the end, and it'll look like it's standing up. You come back an hour later, and it's perfectly flat. So don't even try and get that in there.
Gotcha. Now, working in plastic, since you know, sometimes we're embedding styrene parts mm-hmm. into this. Does it generate significant heat while curing?
You know, it doesn't. I was kind of thinking it would, but one thing you have to particularly pay attention to is leakage. So if you're putting it into a base, you got to really make sure your perimeter is well sealed. It's like you've seen the Night Shift videos where he does which one of you guys likes the side water?
Dave likes it. I don't. Okay.
Mike hates sidewater, and that's a debate for a whole other episode. We're going to get into that at some point, but not tonight.
Okay. Just make sure it doesn't leak, because if you have a leak, and the stuff will find it'll seep through the smallest hole. So I always kind of pre-seal it with some Cellutex paper mache or some kind of AK still water or something. Just make sure all your seams are sealed and you don't want any leakage, because if it leaks, it's too late and it gets all over the place and the stuff's really hard to get up.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Now, do you have to pour it in layers, or can you pour it in one? You know, if you're pouring a significant amount of water, can you pour it all in one pour, or do you have to do it in thin or kind of thin applications?
You put it in thin applications, and before you even pour any in, what I like to do is you paint the riverbed or the lake bed or the whatever, and right. You can paint it. You can kind of give the impression of depth with paint, like going kind of lighter to darker colors.
Sure.
And you can kind of work that in. I use oil paints and enamels, or you can use acrylics. You can airbrush it in. But so even before you put the resin down, kind of pay attention to the depth that you want to replicate. And you can get some image of depth, like an inch, but you want it to appear like it's maybe 2 inches and up to the shoreline, which maybe is zero, of course. And then, but so you can paint it so it, you give the impression. So that's kind of step one. Just kind of pay attention to your riverbed, put your rocks down, get your paint in, do your modulation from light to dark, and any plants or weeds you want to put in. So, but like Dave said, you do put it in thin layers. The instructions recommend like an eighth inch at a time, and each layer has to cure like 24 hours. It comes to a full cure in like 72, but it's like 99% there in 24 hours. And you can tint each layers. You can even embed little fish between layers to make them look like they're suspended in the water if you want, mm-hmm. or things like that. But and you can tint the water, and you can tint the top layer or the bottom layer. It depends on what effect you're looking for. But like the JU-188 that's crashed, the Stranded in California, yep. diorama I did, that was built up in probably, must be 12, 15 layers.
I was going to ask, first of all, that is, it's the first model of yours that I ever saw. It, okay. to me, is still one of the most impressive of all of the ones you've done. And it has a very significant scale depth of water in it. So, yeah, I was wondering how many layers it took to get that amount of water in your diorama.
Yeah, that's probably got 12 to 15 layers at an eighth inch or so. And the result is the diorama is pretty heavy too.
Yeah.
So, so that it gets built up, and you can embed the model in it. And I earlier said that I don't use polystyrene to mix the resin material, but I think you probably could, but I still use polyethylene because that seems resistant to more chemicals. But the nice thing about this Envirotex Light, and I think probably the AK product as well, because they make a two-part resin, is the stuff does not attack plastic, and it does not attack paint. So you can put it in there, prop it up at the height you want it, and start pouring the layers, just build it up to the level you want. And of course, each layer will drive just mirror flat. So you have to kind of plan what you're going to do after that to get any waves or ripples. But it does, I think, It either slightly expands or slightly shrinks as it cures. And I say slightly, I mean very slightly. Like the that Friedrich Schaffen FF-60, the scratch-built World War One German triplane, the four-engine job.
You mean the best in IPMS USA best in show Friedrich
that one.
Schaffen. Yeah,
the
that
one.
The one. Let's not undersell it.
The one we affectionately referred to as the Beast, but
yes,
that was the, I remember that one that only had like, it was in a water base, but it only had like maybe four or five layers. But what I noticed about a week after I'd put it done and I got the rigging on and I used a stainless steel, rigging like 0.005 for that, but I'd come back and I'd notice between the floats and the underside of the plane, the struts and the floats where the rigging was down there, is I'd see the rigging was bowed. So I'd release one end of it and I'd reattach it and I'd come back the next couple days and I'd look at it again and I'd see it was bowed again. And I think, I'm not sure if it's if the resin is slightly expanding or slightly contracting, but whatever it's doing, it's impacting some dimensional forces on the model, but they were so slight, I couldn't tell where they were coming from. But after about a week or week and a half, it stopped. So
the next time you would have poured the resin first and then did the rigging a week later.
That's right. Yeah. At least down there.
Yeah.
So, it's so slight, but just, you know, so you're, so our listeners are just kind of aware of that. It's no big deal. I always put the rigging on with a little bit of white glue on each end. So it was just a matter of popping one end loose and reattaching it because that stainless steel wire just springs back perfectly straight each time. So we got the water down, and you can do pretty much any depth you want and make sure it doesn't leak and get your seabed painted the way you want it. The next step, usually people want to get waves and ripples and maybe like the white caps or the foamy stuff crashing up on the beach and things like that. But starting with just some undulations in the water. And what I've been using for that is it's a Liquitex gloss gel medium.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get that at the craft store too. And it's an acrylic clear. And it's kind of it's an acrylic gel and it goes on perfectly white, but it dries perfectly clear. And you can kind of sculpt that with your finger, or I use a baby spoon.
Yeah, consistency, it looks like really thick white glue.
Yes. Yeah, it does. And Vihalo makes one called, they make a similar product. And I think AK makes a product. I think MIG Ammo makes a product now that's very similar. But I usually get the Liquitex glass gel medium because it's cheaper. And it's really the same stuff. But it holds its shape. So if you're trying to get waves and ripples in, use that. And I use a baby spoon because I want the smooth curved underside just so you can... I used to do it with a brush, but the brush oddly leaves kind of brush marks, for lack of a better term.
Right.
So when it dries, you get these kind of lines through it that looks like brush. So I thought, what can I use? So we had some old baby spoons from when our kids were little, and so I repurposed one of those for my model bench now, and I use that to get the waves.
Real nice
in.
Silver one.
Yeah. That's right. So then let that dry and perfectly clear, and that's usually a day or two, and that's ready to go. And then if you want to take it another step further, you can put in white caps or like water when water crashes up against a float on a float plane or up against a beach or a rock or something. You want a little white in there. So you can take that Liquitex glass gel medium again, and you can add a little bit of acrylic flat white to it, just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you can apply it the same way just in the areas you want it, and that'll dry with a very nice a white translucent look to it. And you can take some water and you can kind of blend it in with what you've already put down too. So you can get a very nice graduated white caps and foam against a beach and such. So
now let me go back for one second to the acrylic or the two-part epoxy.
Mm-hmm.
When you've poured it and it's dried and you've got something embedded partially in it, mm-hmm. does it pull away from the model at all for you to have to go back and dress the edge between the acrylic and the, or the epoxy and the model, or does it stay tied up against it, if you know what I mean?
Yes, I know what you mean. It stays put, and there's okay. no gaps. Yeah. So, and there's no gaps around the perimeter of the diorama base either. So
gotcha.
The stuff is very, very adhesive to everything it touches, including your clothes. So, or the tabletop that your wife was upset about.
Gotcha.
So, okay.
So don't wear your Sunday suit and don't do it on the wife's tablecloth.
That's right. Use lots of newspapers and have a yep. roll of paper towels handy. And so.
So a couple of things. One's general, and I think it is, I think maybe why some people find it hard, especially people like me, because especially with the, you know, you're tinting this gel with just a little bit of white, and you've, mm-hmm. I think you've talked about how much you experiment versus how much you actually do finished sure. type work. Mm-hmm. I think what scares a lot of people is with some of these products, there's a little bit of a leap of faith because you're not going to know what it looks like until it dries.
Yes. And that's especially true of adding the white. So you take a little dollop of the Liquitex gel medium and put maybe like 3 dollops on it and put a tiny bit of white in one and a little bit more in the next and a little bit more in the third, and then apply it to a practice piece, a mule diorama, if, sort of. And then you can see, and just record how much percentage you put in each, and then you can see exactly what you're doing and what the effect you want. And you can always add more, so it's better to err on the side of having less.
Gotcha.
And then so. my other thing I wanted to mention was you're saying this stuff stays put, and I was – that's a good thing to know with the product that you're using, because I've seen – I don't know whether it was in model railroading or dioramas I've seen in publication or at shows where whatever product they're using is trying to crawl up.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
It's yeah.
kind of trying to form a meniscus against whatever it's up against, and you get this really unnatural looking climb.
Yeah, it does do that.
Transitions. Yeah.
It will do that.
Okay.
So you have to kind of, not a lot, but it is noticeable. But you can mitigate that with the Liquitex glass gel medium.
Okay.
Because it will kind of creep up the sides of the base, and it'll creep up onto the side of the model a little bit and up to, you know, just – so, yeah, you can cure that with the gel medium. You can hide a lot of sins with that stuff. So, I was going to say the – I think the other diorama I just finished with the AR-196, which was I titled "Lost at Sea." I think I sent you the photos of that one.
Yeah, we'll post these photos in the dojo and elsewhere.
Okay, now that one was a little different because I used the same materials, but I applied them a little differently, and the way I prepared kind of the seabed. That first of all, that's a Arado AR-196 that's been shot up, and it's abandoning in the North Sea somewhere, and it's in a storm, and the sea is just roiled up around it, and the pilot and observer are desperately trying to get into a life raft off the side of the plane before the plane sinks. So that kind of sets the scene a little bit. But what I did there is it's not a flat base, and the base of the diorama is kind of angled upward, because I wanted to give the drama of a roiling sea. So what I had to do there is apply the Envirotex light in kind of stages, and I'd kind of have to angle the base for each application, because most of it is cellulose paper mache on top of cut and formed extruded polystyrene, kind of like the material that Night Shift uses. So yeah. you can kind of carve in the shades and shave the waves and the everything, but so a lot of that doesn't have a lot of depth. But I did want to show some depth in some places that are noticeable in some deeper areas. But each of those deeper areas had to be done separately because the whole base is on an angle, and if you just pour it at the top, it's all going to come downhill. So you have to kind of angle it up so each undulation where I wanted to show depth had to be kept level when I poured that portion of it. And then you go to the next one and you pour that portion of it and so on until all those little areas are covered. And then you can go back with the Liquitex glass gel medium and work it in that way. But because this stuff, it will find its the lowest spot on your model and go to it, no matter where it is. You have to kind of pay attention.
For the wet effect, the effect of a wet surface, so just looking at your Arado 196, but you've got the one pontoon that's almost completely in the water.
Broken.
And
up.
So it's been covered by water, but it's not submerged or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Do you use just something like Future to make it look wet, or do you use some other technique to give the effect of a wet surface?
Yeah, there is a fourth application. We talked about the Envirotex Light, and we talked about the Liquitex glass gel medium, and then we talked about the tinted white glass gel medium.
Right.
There's a fourth application that I put on a heavy brushed coat of either Future or a glass kind of Mod Podge, acrylic material, and that will help unify everything and give everything kind of a uniform glossiness. And one other thing with that lost at sea diorama is there's some foamy areas where the ship is, or the plane is hitting the water, or the waves are crashing up against it so hard that it's really foamy looking.
Right.
And you can replicate that. Is it one of the things I've said before, I'm kind of a sucker for modeling how-to books.
Yeah.
So there's one, a couple books. There's AK FAQ series called Water, Ice, and Snow. And they had
I've got that.
Yeah, they had one technique in there where they used a polyester film material, which looks a lot like cotton. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of pull it apart, and you can embed it with some of the two-part epoxy resin, and you can kind of shove it in and under and next to things where there's so much foam in the water that the cotton, or the, not cotton, the polyester fiber fill is a good replica for that. Mm-hmm. And where the actual splashes occur, what you can do is take that same polyester fill, pull it apart into thin strands, and you can stretch it over the top of like a plastic cup, tape it down around the perimeter, so you have kind of a spider webby looking thing over the top of the cup, and then use a product like AK's still water, which is an acrylic liquid crystalline material, and Vihalo makes one called Water Effects. It's the same thing. And what you do is apply that to that spider webbing thing that you just taped down over the top of that cup and let it dry overnight, and then release it from the cup in the morning. You can cut that out, and there you got some water splashes that you can then apply next to the foam, next to the plane or the ship where the water is crashed up against and the water is splashed out. And you can actually put that in piece by piece, and that's pretty effective.
I never would have thought of that. I can, looking at that photograph of that diorama, I can actually see where you've done that. I just never would have thought of that application of that material.
Yeah, it's pretty effective. I was kind of surprised too, but and it's easy. So, and it cuts with scissors. So you can put it on with white glue, or just put it on. I think I just used more Liquitex glass gel medium, and you can use that as an adhesive, and you can put that against where the pontoons hit in the water, where the fuselage is hit in the water, and that kind of thing. And it's, and polyester film material is better to use than cotton, because cotton absorbs it.
Right.
And the polyester will just, become a part of it, and it won't absorb it. So it looks more natural. There's some other products, and those are kind of the techniques I used for that one. The Lost at Sea diorama and Stranded in Kilfonia. And I think I sent you the photos of a Battle of Britain 109E that was
right.
crashed on the beach. Yeah. And the same techniques were used in that one too, with the two-part epoxy resin and the gel medium and the tinted water. And I didn't use the foam there, but so these techniques are adaptable, and you can exaggerate them or subdue them. It doesn't, you know, it's a lot of different ways you can manipulate them. So,
well, moving on from water, the next logical discussion is either frozen water as ice or frozen water as snow. Which way do you want to go, snow or ice?
Oh, let's start with snow.
Okay. Now, here's an area where I think the products that we have gotten in the last 5 years have made doing snow a ton easier than in the before time.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, it's we used to be stuck with things like baking soda and flour.
Which yellowed and attracts bugs. I was going to say, or flour, which attracts bugs.
Yeah. Yeah, it's yeah, before now AK has before we leave water, I had one other product I wanted to mention.
Go ahead.
AK and Vihalo makes a product. Well, AK calls it still water, and Vihalo's product is called Water Effects. Mm-hmm. And that's an acrylic material that's pretty good just for making like puddles and shell holes and things.
Yeah.
And it's not as toxic as the resin material, so.
Yeah, you don't want to mix up a whole bunch of resin just to fill a couple of shell holes on a small vignette with water.
Right. And that stuff comes really in a convenient little squeeze bottle too, so.
Yeah.
And you can tint that with acrylics. That works pretty well for that. Yeah. And that's the material I used with the stretched over polyester over the top of the cup to get the splashes too. And that stuff works well with that.
Good.
But yeah, the snow, you're right, Dave. I think the best stuff I think MIG Ammo and AK Diorama series have both come out with a lot of nice new products. And some of it is stuff we've had in the past, but had to kind of search down. And you don't want to use baking soda, and you don't want to use flour, and you don't want, but for the reasons we just talked about. But I think even Verlinden and a couple other off brands used to make things like micro balloons, glass micro balloons.
Yes.
You gotta wear an N95 when you use that stuff. By the way,
you do not want to inhale that stuff, and people don't realize it. I mean, my sister's a doctor, and she will tell you that stuff, people, you know, if you're working with it, people don't realize it gets in the air, mm-hmm. and next thing you know, you have it in your lungs, and it's there forever doing all sorts of bad things.
Yeah, it's not like asbestos, but, you know, if you look at asbestos under a microscope, it's these sharp, pointy little things. Snow micro balloons are like glass little balls, but they'll, I think, more have a chance to work themselves out. But it's just, you just don't want to inhale that stuff. So
yeah,
I'd recommend a N95. But we had the micro balloons are especially useful for a 72nd scale.
Yeah.
And with armor modelers, especially, it's such a good replication of really small scale snow. I've used it on tanks. I think the diorama I sent you called a spring thaw curiosity. Mm-hmm. It shows that's the Vespid Panther tank, and it's on a hillside, and there's three GIs looking at it. And there's melted snow underneath and around it. But on the tank itself, I've used the AK's snow micro balloons. And you can put those on. I fashioned a little tool out of an old popsicle stick with a little spoon on the end of it. So, and with some diluted white glue applied to the tank with a toothpick in the nooks and crannies where you want it. And then you drop some of the micro balloons on top of that. And you do that over and over. And then I take it outside and blow it off. And then you can come back and you can add to it and add to it. But the stuff is so fine and it's so white, and it has such a good look for snow and 72nd scale, and I'm sure it'd work in 35th also.
Yeah.
The other materials AK makes, they make a terrains snow, which is quite good, and they make something called snow sprinkles, which is a little coarser and a little icier. But they all got their use, and the terrain snow is quite good too. I use some of that on that same diorama, a spring thaw curiosity.
Now is that like a paste?
It is. It's like a paste, and it is an acrylic material, and you can dilute it with water. You can apply it to the base or to the treads or to where the tank has gone past or whatever, and you can use some water on a brush to dilute it and let it soak in around and kind of feather it out. And it's just beautiful material. And again, experiment on something else. It's kind of expensive, but I think one jar will last quite a while. So
sure.
So yeah, the snow micro balloons, the terrain snow, and the snow sprinkles together, all of them can be worked with as an acrylic paste and diluted white glue, and they all got their
now,
good uses.
When you've applied these different items of snow, do you ever go back? Once they've dried or set in place or whatever, do you ever go back and, say, apply an acrylic gloss or any sort of post? Or do you ever coat them to either make them look wetter or shinier or sparklier or any of that? Or did in your experience, has it just been that when they dry, they look convincing without any further work?
Yeah, I think the materials we just talked about, the micro balloons, the terrain snow, and the snow sprinkles all look best if left alone.
Hmm. Have you ever tried to tint the terrain snow with like brown to make it look like dirty or muddy snow?
Yeah, you can do that with acrylics.
Okay.
Or yellow yeah. snow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Or yellow well. Snow. Don't eat
hey,
that, though.
He's from Minnesota. He knows not to eat the yellow snow.
Yeah, that's right. There's another product out there that's quite good. It's made in the UK. It's called Precision Ice and Snow.
Mm-hmm.
And they make two different sizes of snow powder, fine. And they call one that's fine, which they say is for scales 1 to 160th to 35th scale. And they make another snow powder called Extra, which is more sparkly, and that's 1 to 135th to 116th scale. I placed an order with them a couple of years ago, and they sent an extra bag of the fine along, which was nice. And they've got videos on YouTube on how to use their products. But you mentioned overcoating the other materials, Dave, which I don't do with the materials we just talked about, but the Precision Ice and Snow materials, they do recommend that.
Mm, okay.
They recommend, they have a, well, they've got a guidebook that comes with their kit, and they've got YouTube videos that show them how to use their products, but they've got kind of a matte clear spray that you can get at any craft store, but they recommend that to seal it in. But they've got a fascinating approach to theirs. They've got some of their videos show how to apply an adhesive onto a base, like the trees and the terrain, and then you actually sprinkle this snow powder through a sieve that they also carry, and it clings to all the branches and sits on the rocks, and just adheres to all horizontal surfaces, just like snow actually falls. And then you seal it in with the clear matte varnish spray afterward. But it works really well. But it takes a little practice. So yeah, Precision Ice and Snow is worth looking into. And they've they've got a material called for armor modelers too, called Superfine Camo Chipping Paint, which is kind of a chalky acrylic, which you can brush on and then kind of rub off. But it looks really convincing for like winter worn schemes on, you know, a T-34 or something.
Yeah. Like a white, the leftovers of a whitewasher.
Exactly. Yeah. It's, and you can put it on in multiple coats. And then they've got another product called Snow Wash, which is a more of a liquid that it's like the way that snow and ice collects around nooks and crannies, like on a tank's engine deck or something. That's really convincing. But if you look at their videos, you'll see what I mean. It's it takes a little precision ice and snow, but it takes a little practice to use. But the effects are really, really good.
I have to look for that.
Yeah, the videos are worth looking at too. But yeah, the fallen snow on the trees and the rocks, and it's real convincing. I sent you some photos of the diorama. I think it's called just another day on the Eastern Front with the crashed HE-111 in the snow.
Yeah,
and that's done with precision ice and snow.
Well, I do think ice and snow snow at least has gotten a lot easier in the last 5 years because of all these products. And yes. I'm not unconvinced that if you've looked around the diorama space as far as model shows, mm-hmm. I'm seeing more and more winter dioramas, and I'm mm-hmm. not unconvinced that part of the reason is it has now become much easier to do, and people are doing it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it gives people a lot more confidence when they're given better products to use.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I've noticed that too. And the ones that are using it, the effects are becoming more and more convincing, I think, too.
Sure beats the baking soda.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, the biggest problem with that one, I always thought, was that it's a mild desiccant. Right. So, depending on how much the humidity fluctuates in your house, and I've had this happen, not as a snow diorama, but years ago, we used to we glue baking soda to a muffler to get that texture, you know, before you rust paint it. And then mm-hmm. I was looking at one I'd done, you know, a year and a half after the fact, and there's like this water droplet hanging off the back of the muffler.
Ooh.
Because it's a desiccant, so it during the summer, I guess it had absorbed the water out of the air in the house.
Oh.
And then it shifted back the other way at some point. It got saturated, and then the humidity in the house went down or went up. I don't know. And then it's starting to leach back out of the baking soda.
Oh, that's not good.
Well, I think that takes us to, rather naturally, ice.
Yeah, ice. Ice is a little different, kind of different animal.
Well, I'm sure being from Minnesota, you've seen ice and you've seen all the different ways ice can present, because ice can be anything from just a solid, thick white to all sorts of variations in colors. And then mm-hmm. once you talk about ice that's been shattered or broken or is just starting to form, those all have different looks too.
Yeah, or like the ice I slipped and fell on shoveling my driveway last couple months ago. Left a huge bruise up my left side, but we won't talk about
that. No, we won't talk about that ice.
No.
That's the type of ice you go sprinkle salt on.
Yeah, and that's when you get to a certain age and you go see your doctor and they ask you if you've fallen. Of course, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway. Yeah, like Dave mentioned, there's all kinds of different kinds of ice, and I should have sent you some pictures of the HE-115. You can probably get them off of one of the Facebook sites. I think Barracuda has got them, but I used on the shoreline. I put the HE-115 in water in a Norway setting with snow on the groundwork that was kind of around it. But since it's kind of a winter scene with open water, but up between the water and the shoreline, I wanted to replicate some sheets of ice that were formed but still in place, even though it was open water further out. And you can how moving water sometimes forms or moves underneath ice that's kind of protruding out from shore a little bit. And I wanted to replicate that. And one way you can do that is using that AK product, still water, again, that acrylic liquid or Vahalo's water effects. And you can put that on a hard, non-porous surface and mix in some microballoons, some of the snow microballoons, into that material and kind of spread it out on top of the surface. And then when it dries, you just let it kind of randomly form. But when it dries, you can peel it off, you can cut it, and then kind of push it in against the shoreline and kind of mix it in with the, you can adhere it with the snow material, the snow acrylic material. And then you can pour the resin underneath it up until just until it gets underneath up to it, but not quite touching it. So you can replicate that fairly easily with that.
I never would have thought of that. So you can take the still water, put some micro balloons on it, spread it on like a sheet of glass or something hard and flat, super smooth. And then when it dries, you can just pull it up.
Yeah. I used to use Saran Wrap as a base, but the stuff shrinks as it dries, and it kind of bunched up the Saran Wrap.
So
don't use that. But just to facilitate peeling it off later, you can put a very thin layer of Vaseline on the glass or an old ceramic tile or something, and then pour it on that, and then it'll just peel right up, and you can use scissors to cut it, and then you can just fit it in piece by piece right against your shoreline and work it in with the snow material, and you've got these thin little sheets of ice sticking out on top of the water out from the shore. So
that's cool.
So that's one way to do that. You can make thicker sheets of ice, like if a tank is crossing a lake or something and the ice is cracking, or maybe the tank falls through. Again, that precision ice and snow makes a material called Kreisel ice sheets, and they're bought kind of as is. It looks like they're about an eighth inch thick. I don't have any, but I saw it on their site, and you can buy it eighth inch, and you can break it up and just position it where you want it. You can airbrush the backside of it to tint it blue or green or whatever, and then you can put their snow product or not on top, or the AK snow products on top, and work it into the shoreline. And you can have it, you know, down where someone's fallen through or not. And so they make a product like that precision ice and snow. Or you can use the two-part epoxy resin we talked about, and you can put that in a mold and pour it maybe an eighth inch layer with a mold on a ceramic tile or something, and you have the edges sealed off again, like we talked. And again, with a very thin, maybe Vaseline coat down. But when that's cured, you can pop that up and break that apart and use that. And that's like just like glass smooth. And you can bust that out after a couple of days and use that in the same kind of way. And you can get thicker ice that way, or you can get thinner ice, like we talked about, using the AK still water and such.
I've seen a few builds where folks have used like sheets of cast paraffin.
Yeah, wax. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nothing you've tried yet?
I haven't tried the wax yet. I was kind of, because that just, it takes too many dents and scratches too easily.
So it has an aversion to about everything you'd want to tint it with.
Like heat. Yeah.
Or glue it with. Yeah. Heat would be bad.
Yeah. there's one other thing. one of the other pictures of another diorama I sent was, it's called a casualty of Operation Steinbeck. And it's a crashed, Junkers Ju-88S that had come back from a night mission and went off the end of the runway and crashed down into this drainage ditch. And in the drainage ditch, it's winter time, and the ditch is full of kind of running water, but it's water that's, you know, frozen over and refrozen and opened up and broken. And, you know, every night it freezes, and every day it comes up, unfreezes, but it's, I used a different kind of ice material there. I used the clear sheet plastic that you get from the box tops on like Christmas cards. don't know if you're familiar with those kind of things. And that plastic makes a great material for vac forming your own canopies too, by the way. So I save that whenever we send Christmas cards. So, but that stuff is really, really thin. That's maybe, half a millimeter or less. And you can cut that with scissors, any size, shape you want. And you can submerge that into the resin material or into the still water. And you can tint it, you can paint it, you can work up the snow material in and around it. But you can get some good looking shards and ice that way too.
Well, I noticed. Well, one of the dioramas you sent your King Tiger after the Ardennes offensive, and it's a photograph that I recognize. There's a guy on top of it holding. I guess it's some kind of telecom wire off right. the top of the tank, trying to get under it. I'm not sure what he's doing, being mm-hmm. silly maybe, but.
Showing off for the local women, I think.
Yeah. And then along the side skirts of that vehicle, there's a bunch of icicles.
Yeah, that was done with clear stretch sprue.
Really?
Yeah. And then you can put a little, you can stretch that to any thickness you want. And you put it on just with some white glue, and you can put little, you can round the edges and then just, paint it on with future to, afterward to get rid of any dullness you've done from the sanding to shape or stuff. So it's a little tedious putting them on, but
I was about to say, how long did that take?
Anything worth doing is worth, so, but it's a small effect. Most people don't notice. I'm impressed you saw that. So it's good.
Well, I was quite familiar with the photograph you based it off of because it's just one I was real familiar with. And
you and Mike both have affinity for being inspired by and modeling off of photographs that you've seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's why I wouldn't have ever picked that one.
And that's another one. I use that precision ice and snow material for the snow on the ground and on the bushes and back of the King Tiger. And also used it on the engine deck. I've got a lot more photos of that one that shows kind of that other material used on the engine deck and that material you can kind of abrade on the sides of the turret and such too. So
yeah, the old school icicle method was tube glue.
Mm.
Oh yeah, I remember that. Isn't that may well be in one of those early diorama books?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot harder to control, though. Boy,
probably. You have to make 1,000 of them to get 100 that are the right size.
Yeah, the clear stretch sprue works pretty well, and it's a lot easier to control. And
I've noticed that you seem to have an affinity for water, ice, and snow. Now, is that just because there are a fair number of photographs of all, if you listen, there's a great podcast called We Have Ways of Making You Talk about World War II history with Al Murray and James Holland.
Okay.
And they constantly make reference to the fact that the winters in the early 1940s, from 40 to 45, were some of the worst winters of that century.
I've heard that, yeah.
And so I'm wondering if just because of that fact that there are more photographs of heavier winter and you're inspired by photographs and therefore you end up doing more water, ice, and snow effects, or you like water, ice, and snow effects, so you're drawn to them and seek out which is the chicken and which is the egg.
I think I'm more drawn to those because I like the contrasts it sets up with the subject.
Gotcha.
So because in our scales, I like to work with a lot of light and dark contrast because I think that helps set the model off better. So I think those scenes tend to look better and more attractive.
Mm-hmm.
But on the one Mike mentioned, the King Tiger and the Ardennes, that's I think that photo, it's been shown in a few different places, but the one I was primarily going from was the one that's in the that thick volume, The Battle of the Bulge, Then and Now.
Oh, yes. I've got the entire Then and Now series.
Yeah, just a tremendous series, and that's a really good book. That's got numerous winter tank idea, diorama tank ideas in there. So, but
Well, if you don't have their, they have a companion series called Through the Lens after the battle If you don't have the Battle of the Bulge book in from the Through the Lens series, you probably ought to get that one too.
Yeah.
Well, and I know I'm sure that Mark has the one for Ploesti, the Through the Lens on Ploesti, which is just awesome.
Oh, he's got a huge library.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had zero doubt that that he has that book.
Well, speaking of references, though, there's a MIG ammo reference called the Weathering Magazine. You're probably familiar with that.
Yeah.
And they've got quite a few issues that deal with water, ice, and snow. And I like that series because it's they go into kind of detail, you know, for each effect. And they've got one titled Beach that has a lot of good examples in it. They got one called Water. They've got one called Snow and Ice, and one called KO. I think it means knocked out. And another called Seaplanes. But all of those six issues, five issues, I'm sorry, have a lot of good ideas for replicating water, ice, and snow too.
And if I'm not mistaken, you can purchase those as PDFs. You can purchase those electronically, and you may be able to purchase individual articles inside of them. Now, I'm not 100% sure about that, but so those things are available in electronic format.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Then there's another, the last one is, I'm not even sure how to pronounce it, Abtalung 502. They have a softcover series of books. They have one titled in their Model Master or Master Model series titled Water, Light, and the Works. It's ABT 803, and that's got some really good examples of some master modelers in there that are really impressive work. So,
well, I've got one I could add to the list.
Go ahead.
I don't know if this magazine's still around, but for a while there was a magazine called Extreme Modeling.
Oh, sure.
They had a series of books, Elements in Combat, and there's one called Frozen Hell. It's volume two. Now, it's probably about 70% model construction and 30% diorama groundwork.
Mm.
But there's some useful winter stuff in here, and I'm thumbing through it right now. That's where I saw the diorama of the – it's a Soviet T-26 falling through the ice, and the guy used paraffin to make the big blocks.
Oh, okay. Well, if you're thinking of doing that as a diorama, check out that material from Precision Ice and Snow, because they've got something that would work pretty well. Or you could make your own with the two-part epoxy.
Yeah.
So, Steve, I've got to ask, what are you currently working on?
Let's see. I just finished two. I finished a ME262 in a natural metal finish with the putty on the on the lines. And
is that inspired by the pictures of the ones that were found at the end of the war?
Right. This one was at Swabish Hall manufacturer.
Gotcha.
And it's from a photo. It's the one Verk number 712, 111712. It's the one built after the one we brought back, tested at the end of the war. And it's got a couple photos in an old series called Broken Eagles. I don't know if you remember.
I remember that series.
Yeah, it's on their ME262. And there's a few photos of this one sitting out in a field, kind of flowers. And it's not a diorama, but I did make a base for it just with kind of tall grass and some flowers to stick it in. And it's kind of an interesting bird because it's got natural metal, but the two engines look like they're taken from an operational aircraft because they're camouflaged. It's kind of unusual. So, and then what I'm working on now, after I finish that, I've got another vac form on the bench. So, another one from your neck of the woods, Sierra Scale.
Oh yeah, I Mike and I both know Bob Norgren.
Yeah. He did some of the best vac models. I'm doing a 72nd scale Hansa Brandenburg W18,
okay.
which is
I know what that is.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay. It's a a pusher, single engine pusher, biplane, single seat, Austro-Hungarian fighter. And alongside it, I'm also doing a Phoenix D2. It's from the old Mac distribution, both 72nd scale, and going to experiment with the camouflage on the Phoenix because they have something called a green spring or an autumn leaf kind of camouflage, which was applied with sponges in real life, but I'm not sure how I'm going to replicate it, so I'm going to have to do some experimenting and see what might look halfway decent on that one. But
first, I'm going to blame you for, or give you credit for the fact that Mike recently pulled the trigger on the Vespid Tiger, and I think at least in part because of your work on the Vespid Panther.
But I aspire to be a bad influence.
There you go.
Hey, you're doing a good job.
Okay.
The other thing, of all the things to build, why the Vacuform W18? I mean, that's awfully obscure.
It is. It's such a cool looking plane, though.
So, did you find a photograph of it?
There you go.
I found a few photos of it. There's the Aeronaut series of the World War One books are soft covers by Aeronaut. Colin Owens does some, and Jack Harris does a bunch. And I found a bunch of photos in there. I can't remember, it's volume 2. It's on Hansa Brandenburg biplane seaplanes. And the thing's like 3/4 inches thick, and it's just only that subject. And it's a lot of photos I've never seen before, so I'm going to do that one. And then the Phoenix D2, they're both a little different. I like to do different stuff. I don't like to do the stuff everybody else does, I guess. But
you and Mike both.
Although I do buy the other stuff. Like when Edward comes out with their BF-109 series in 72nd scale.
I almost bought one of those in the hobby shop the other day. The Eve. E3 or E4.
You're thinking of the special hobby one.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, like Edward's coming out with a whole 109 series starting next month, I think. So,
yeah.
But, and I think Barry Numerick says, he's in trouble. I got an email from
him.
He'll
be fine.
Yeah, we were talking about it with Barry back and forth in emails, and Mark and I and Barry, and we were talking about that release coming up and how screwed we all are because it's going to do a number and break our wallets. And Barry, we talked about Hannett's having one pre-order, back order, or a pre-order offer. And Barry comes back with an email, says, I have sinned.
Well, Steve, to close out on topic, what water, snow, or ice diorama have you not done yet that you're really itching to do?
Great question.
Oh. I've got I make a lot of use of Post-its notes and in my library on my shelves. And if we can get Dave up here for NordicCon, I'll show it to you. But I've probably got a couple hundred Post-it notes on various photo pages of various books in my library. And I'd say there's probably another dozen that are dealing with the snow or water, but it'd be hard to pick one out right away. I mean, just out of memory. But another nice thing about this is you can do simple bases for your models with this too. And you can, you can create a small base for a seaplane or a float plane. Just with some water, just sitting in water, like it's natural environment, an IL-2 Stormovic with skis instead of the landing gear. You can have it just sitting on a plain snow base that it's, scraped through, and you can show that where it landed, and just real simple, but very offsetting. And so there's a lot of ways you can use these materials, not necessarily only for dioramas, but to create, really convincing backdrops for your models.
All right. You got anything else, Dave?
Nope. I think that's it. And I will tell you, I am going to try very hard to get up to NordicCon this year. I've got that hard pencil in, and I am really going to try and do that.
Okay. Well, we'll put you up.
Well, thanks again, Steve. It's been a pleasure, and we'll have you back on some other topic before too long.
It's always a pleasure talking with you guys.
Absolutely. All right.
Well, Dave, you want to do a winter diorama now?
I want to do winter. I want to do ice. I want to do snow. Steve, as always, a great conversation, B, always inspiring. And just like when we talk with Dr. Miller, I learn new stuff every time. It's fantastic for me personally, as well as getting to let Steve talk to a wider audience. So I enjoyed the heck out of it.
Good stuff, folks. So let's see some winter dioramas now, or water dioramas for that matter.
So this is probably not going to be a surprise, Mike, but tell me, how did your bullet orange label go over?
The bullet orange label is good. I still like it, but I'm thinking it's losing, Dave.
Oh, you think the Russell's has knocked it off its perch?
I think the Russell's 10 years knocked it off its perch. And
oh, my gosh.
I think the difference between these two is the bullet, because of their mash bill, leans way toward the spice side. And the Russell's is a little bit sweeter, and it's just a little bit easier drink.
You know what? Having had both, I would not disagree with that.
So I think the fave is now the Russell's 10 year.
All right. Now we'll need to reach out to them and see if we can get a sponsorship deal.
And it makes me curious what's going to knock it off its perch.
Regular supply of Weller Special Reserve.
Well, that ain't happening.
Yeah, I know.
Well, what about you?
I'm at the end of the Triptych Brewing. I think my spaceship knows which way to go. It was really good. 7.4% alcohol, so strong, but not obnoxiously strong. And it definitely is citrusy, and it is double hop. I mean, they're not lying. There's hop in there, but it's not obnoxiously hoppy. You know, Tommy, Choi, I want to thank you. This was a good choice, and definitely something I'd drink again. Mike, we're at the end of the episode. Do you have a shout out?
I got a couple, so if you've got one, we'll alternate.
Okay, I've got one, but it's a good one.
First up is Kevin Hernstadt. He's our latest Patreon contributor. Kevin has chosen to contribute to Plastic Model Mojo via Patreon. If you'd like to do that and support the show like Kevin did, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com/plasticmodelmojo. There with Patreon, they'll help you manage a recurring contribution. You can contribute anything from a dollar on up, any amount of your choice. Patreon will handle the billing of that. If you'd like to manage your own contribution or do a one-and-done contribution to Plastic Model Mojo, you can do so by going to www.plasticmodelmojo.com. In the upper right-hand corner of the screen, you'll see a heart icon that will take you directly to a PayPal link. There you can make a one-time contribution or manage your own recurring contribution. Folks, we really appreciate this. It's helping pay for hosting. It's helping pay for a lot of other software applications we use in the background to bring you this show. And really, really appreciate it. So thank you very much. We appreciate every penny you offer. It's just really flattering that folks, in a sense, vote with their wallet. They want to help support the show because they appreciate the content we're bringing in. It's very flattering. We appreciate it very much.
My shout out is, believe it or not, the United States Postal Service. I have cause to recently ship a 15-pound package that was 18 inches by 18 inches by 18 inches to the other side of the world, to Australia. And the folks at the USPS were really good about helping giving me an estimate of the cost. Then boxed it up, took it to them. They processed it, took the package. Pretty much 10 days after I mailed it, it arrived in Australia. Now, it has not yet reached its final destination, but we know it's in Australia, so the rest of it's up to the Australian Postal Service. But we all like to complain about the post office, but you got to give them credit for doing what they do And, you know, in the scheme of things, shipping 15 pounds halfway around the world for basically $10 a pound is an amazing, amazing thing in this day and age. So shout out to the guys and gals at the USPS. Your work is not unnoticed.
Well, my final shout out is to Mr. Brandon Walters, and Brandon is from Guelph, Ontario. And he gave us some beer at Heritage Con, Dave, and we were wondering who did this because we did a crappy job up there, just like we did at Nats in Omaha, Nebraska.
Hey, I knew Tommy Choi gave us the triptych at Indy, so what's this wee thing? I think this on you.
No, you need to go back and listen to the last episode, Dave.
Okay, go ahead.
He gave us the Bourbon Barrel Imperial Stout. Kind of in the generic space can. It used to be called UVB-76 after the supposed Russian Dead Hand radio station. The beer was renamed after the invasion of Ukraine. Or maybe it's still to be named. I don't know. He also asked if we have an Untappd account listeners can follow. No, we do not, but that's not a bad idea.
I actually do have an Untappd account. I'll post that to the dojo.
Got any more, Dave?
Nope. That's it for me, Mike.
If that's it, we're at the end of a long one, man, for us. So
I know.
As we always say,
so many kids,
so little time, Dave. We'll catch you on the flip side.